nine.
Do we have any public comments?
Oh, I'm sorry, no public comment on that one. But there are on number nine, so I got them right here. Thank you for that. This is a Coastal Dungeness Crab Whale Entanglement briefing and public comment, and good afternoon, Michelle. Nice to see you again.
Good afternoon, Chair Carpenter and Commissioners.
Okay.
Good morning. Do you get up now?
Good morning. Afternoon.
Dave, we're on number nine, the Coastal Dungeness Crab Whale Entanglement. And
excellent. Okay.
This does not work. Thank you, Commissioners. We seem to be having some technical difficulties pulling up our PowerPoint.
Is that you, Dave?
Thank you again. My name is Michelle Culver, and with me is Heather Hall, and we're with the Intergovernmental Ocean Policy Group in the FISH program. And we are here today to follow up on our previous briefings with you, which occurred in January and May of this year, on the whale entanglements in the coastal Dungeness crab fishery, and to review proposed rules that we are bringing forward to, in an attempt to reduce the likelihood of whale entanglements in this fishery. So what you should have in preparation for this is a summary sheet, as well as a summary of all of the discussions and actions that have occurred in 2019, a copy of a letter that we sent out to all coastal crab license holders. That included a copy of the proposed rule changes, as well as a description of the intent and rationale of each of those changes that we'll be reviewing with you here today. We are proposing that there be public comment today on the proposed rules. We'll additionally be holding a separate public hearing on these rules as well before you take your scheduled final action, which will be in January of next year. So just briefly, we'll provide a summary of the issues, provide an update on large whale entanglements. NOAA has released their annual report on large whale entanglements on the West Coast. We'll review that information relative to the 2018 data, which had not been available at the time of our last briefing. We'll review the actions that we've taken in 2019. The proposed regulatory changes, which would take effect for the next crab season, which is the 2019 to 2020 crab season, and walk through our proposed next steps and timeline. So just as an overview of the coastal Dungeness crab fishery, in looking at the ex-vessel revenue of all of our coastal commercial fisheries, coastal Dungeness crab consistently produces the highest ex-vessel revenue, averaging about $48 million to the harvesters in the last 5 years. It is a unique fishery in that the states of Washington, Oregon, and California have delegated authority to manage the fishery out to 200 miles, and that delegated authority is in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. We have a tri-state agreement with Oregon and California, so we try our best to coordinate relative to science criteria and standards such as domoic acid testing, soft shell testing, and on regulations. We have a limited entry fishery, so there's 223 licenses. About 200 of those are active. We also have vessel length restrictions to limit the effort in this fishery, and we implemented a pot limit of either 300 or 500 that's assigned on an individual level that's based on historical landings. And the way the pot limit is enforced is through individual buoy tags. So each license holder has a set of buoy tags that are provided either 300 or 500 at the start of the season. And then each individual pot is tagged with an individually numbered buoy tag. So to briefly summarize what the issues are, what you'll see on the right here is a spatial extent of where our crab fishery occurs, and the darker colors represent a higher fishing intensity. And relative to whale entanglements, from about 2000 to 2013, all of the West Coast fisheries in total averaged about 10 large whale entanglements per year. In 2015, that number jumped from about 10 to 50. And in 2016, there were 48, 31 in 2017, and 46 in 2018. And the increases can be attributed to increasing whale populations. So several of these whale stocks have been listed under ESA and are recovering. And we've had changes in fishing effort and their distribution along the coast, changes in the patterns and the movement of whales, primarily humpback whales. There's also been increased public awareness on whale entanglement, so we have more eyes on the water, more whale entanglements being reported through NOAA. And the suite of fisheries that is encompassed in this West Coast total includes gillnets and then trap or pot fisheries for crab, sablefish, shrimp, and lobster. By far, the majority of these fisheries occur off the state of California. And for Washington, we have pot fisheries for crab and shrimp and sablefish. And then we have gillnet fisheries within Puget Sound. So NOAA released their 2018 report on West Coast whale entanglements and provided more specificity in this report compared to previous reports with regard to the fisheries that the whale entanglements could be attributed to. So the West Coast total is 31 for 2017 and 46 for 2018. These are the large whale entanglements that were confirmed. So that means that there was a NOAA trained responder that confirmed that there was an actual entanglement. And then there will oftentimes be reported entanglements that could be of the same individual animal. So the 46 represents 46 individual animals. The number of reports that were made to NOAA is a much higher number.
Michelle, just a quick question. Does that represent that number of mortality or just?
No, not mortality. So just confirmed whale entanglements. So of those 46 in 2018, roughly half of them, or 24, could be attributed to a specific fishery. And the breakdown of those different fisheries are listed there. So for Washington, the coastal crab fishery had one humpback whale, three gray whales. There was one humpback whale also taken in a tribal coastal crab fishery off of Washington. The California coastal crab fishery took seven humpback whales. The Oregon coastal crab fishery took one humpback whale and one gray whale. There was one humpback whale that was taken in the crab fishery, so it was entangled with crab gear, but the state of origin was unknown. There were two humpbacks in the California spot prawn trap fishery, and four humpbacks and three gray whales that could be attributed to gillnet fisheries. So the key management issues and challenges associated with trying to reduce or avoid, minimize whale entanglements, first of all, relate to the presence of whales. And so there's been a shifting distribution of the whales off the West Coast. As we've experienced varying environmental conditions, that has influenced the distribution of prey. And so the theory is that humpback whales in particular feed on krill and then smaller fishes such as anchovy. And krill was in high abundance, and it's more readily available along the shelf break during that 2000 to 2013 period of when we had about an average of 10 whales being entangled along the West Coast. And since then, in the more recent years, the krill abundance has been down, but there have been higher abundances of anchovy in particular, which are very close to the shore in our bays and estuaries in the mouth of the Columbia River, which has drawn those humpback whales closer to shore for forage purposes. As it relates to fisheries, the data that we have on whale entanglements is very sparse, and so we don't know of a whale entanglement until after it has actually happened, and then it has to be reported and it has to be confirmed. So it's very difficult to predict when the actual entanglement happened or where it occurred. So oftentimes, the entanglements that are reported or attributed to the Washington coastal crab fishery, for example, the entangled whale is reported and confirmed off of California or down in Mexico. And so when the actual entanglement occurred and how long it took that animal to travel that far south, we really don't know. So that makes it really difficult to try and address this through fishing regulations, to try and predict when and where those entanglements could happen. The other thing we wanted to note is that there may not be a one-size-fits-all solution on gear regulations. There's been a lot in the news recently about the North Atlantic right whale trying to address those entanglements on various fisheries on the East Coast. They're trying out some different gear types and there's also some differences, I would note, among the three states on the West Coast, differences relative to our regulations, our the amount of effort that's being put forward, and how the effort is managed. The other thing that we recently learned since our briefing with you in May is relative to the management framework within NOAA, and in particular the reconciliation of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act standards. So to elaborate on that further, the Marine Mammal Protection Act was enacted in 1972, and it protects all marine mammals. The Endangered Species Act followed 1 year later, and humpback whales were listed under the Endangered Species Act in 1973. The Marine Mammal Protection Act specifies or manages take of marine mammals relative to potential biological removal, and there is a limit in the MMPA of 10% of whatever PBR is determined to be as a limit on overall take. Within the ESA, there is no quantitative limit or numerical limit. It simply refers to negligible impact. Within the ESA, for humpback whales, there are 14 distinct population segments. Two of those listed stocks are occur off of the West Coast. The estimated distribution of the distinct population segments off of Washington. Previously, when we briefed you in May, the Hawaiian stock, which is not listed under the ESA, had previously been estimated to represent about 45% of the humpback whales off of Washington. Through recent surveys and research, that updated number is now at 43%. The Mexico population, which is listed as threatened under the ESA, previously had been estimated at 45% off Washington, and that updated number is down to 42%. So the difference there is made up with the Central America stock, which is listed as endangered under the ESA, previously had been thought to represent about 10% of the humpback whales off Washington. The new updated number is about 15%. Conversely, the MMPA does not recognize these 14 distinct population segments, but has lumped them together and defined a California, Oregon, Washington stock. And that stock has a PBR of 16.7 individual animals. And it is based on an assumption of a combined Mexico, Central America, and Hawaiian total population of 2,800 animals. The most recent stock assessments, which have been done by NOAA under the ESA, estimates that the total of the 2,800 for all three stocks that are in the MMPA, that there's 2,800 individuals for just the Mexico stock. In addition to that, there are 780 for Central America and about 11,000 for the Hawaiian stock that have been delisted. So through our discussions with National Marine Fisheries Service, they have indicated, first of all, that as we pursue an incidental take permit under the ESA, we first need to have an MMPA authorization in place for humpback whales. The National Marine Fisheries Service West Coast region is the lead for implementing the Endangered Species Act and decisions relative to incidental take permits. However, NMFS headquarters in Silver Spring is the lead for MMPA issues and reconciling that authorization. So the West Coast region has submitted a proposal to NMFS headquarters and has reached out to them to try and reconcile this issue, in particular for humpback whales, given that the three states have indicated our intent to secure incidental take permits.
So I can continue following. The said in the slide, the MMPA 10% of the potential biological removal, that's the standard, correct, in the Marine Mammal Act. And then the fourth bullet down says MMPA has one California, Oregon, Washington stock with a PBR of 16.7. Can you, based on a combined population, educate me about 10% and the 16.7. I'm I've gotten lost with that. What is a 16.7 a percent?
No, 16.7 individuals are the potential biological removal that's been.
That would be a 10% number?
10% of that would be 1.67, which is what would be the limit under the MMPA relative to takes in fisheries.
Okay.
Sure. I'd like to phone a friend.
Yeah, this is phone a friend. Yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Commission. My name is Nate Pamplin. I'm the Director of Budget and Government Affairs with the department. So, Michelle's correct. PBR is an equation in the Marine Mammal Protection Act that's the limit for all human-caused mortality for marine mammals, whether it's poaching, ship strike, fishing, incidental catch, et cetera. So that is the limit. That equation is adjusted based on whether or not the stock is listed under the Endangered Species Act. So, for instance, if it's listed as threatened, then the correction factor is half of the PBR. If it's listed as endangered, then it is 10%. But that is included in the actual calculation for PBR. So then when NIMS looks at managing stocks through their Pacific Scientific Review Group, they've just combined California, Oregon, and Washington for the purpose of fisheries bycatch into one stock, and the PBR is set at 16.7.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's a terrible title, Commissioner Linville. But so, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe that got to some of the answer here, but on the final two bullets there, I had thought that these are two different estimates of abundance, one from the MMPA that says there's 2,800, and the other one that looks like the estimate is 14,000, 13,000, whatever that adds up to. So I presume that the ESA estimate must be more recent, and the MMPA estimate might be an old one. And the discussion about asking the National Marine Fisheries Service to reconcile this was appropriate. But I wanted to check my thinking that's what's going on here. Are there two different estimates of the same biomass that are substantially different? Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. So our understanding is the MMPA estimate of PBR for the combined stock. Again, these 14 DPSs, so the distinction between Mexico, Central America, and Hawaiian populations is not in the MMPA. It simply defines California, Oregon, Washington stock of all humpback whales off the coast of those states. It has an estimate of a total population of 2,800, resulting in a PBR of 16.7. Our understanding is that number has not been updated since it was established. Conversely, in the ESA, there's been stock assessments, and they're required to do them every 5 years and update the stock status, or they can do it more often if there is a petition to do so.
Science and sound science would lead me to believe that the most recent estimate is probably going to be viewed as the best available science as opposed to the older one. And, yeah, okay.
So in all of this, we are looking to reduce whale entanglements, and that's where we get to the gear. But we're also asking for incidental take permits in the probable event that there will be whale entanglements. My question is, what happens if the number of whale entanglements exceeds or far exceeds our incidental take permits? Do we shut down the fisheries, or what happens?
Yes, that's a good question. So in the development of our incidental take permit, we also develop and submit to NIMS for approval a conservation plan. And part of that conservation plan will specify what our proposed regulations are for this fishery, as well as a number of adaptive management measures. So in developing the conservation plan, we will run through various what-if scenarios. What if there's higher take? What if this happens in this area and during this month, or new science becomes available, or we tried various regulations and they need to be adjusted? So for each of those, there will be kind of an if-then statement. Some of those may then lead to a closure of the fishery. It may lead to a further reduction in the pot limit. It may refer to a further area closure or a seasonal closure. Those are things that we get to develop and propose to NIMS for approval as part of that conservation plan. Once we submit that to NIMS, they will review our ITP application and that conservation plan, and will have the ability to impose additional terms and conditions on that permit, which may line up with what we've specified in the plan or may be in addition to those. By each of the three states submitting applications separately, then if a permit were issued, for example, to Washington, then that permit would allow basically the Washington coastal crab fishery to move forward. If there are additional whale takes by the state of Oregon or the state of California than what had been estimated, or by tribal fisheries, those don't count against our permitted fishery. So our fishery could continue being permitted separately. That being said, we may also want to have some things in our conservation plan for the purposes of protecting the whales and promoting their recovery to still have some responsive measures. Sure. So just briefly to summarize the actions that we have taken in 2019. So we first briefed the commission in January of this year. We then held two stakeholder workshops in March and April to discuss the whale entanglement issue and identify potential management measures. We briefed the commission again at the end of May to provide a status update. Beginning the 1st of July, Director Susiwin implemented an emergency rule to put in place that reduced pot limit, that reduced pots by about one-third of their assigned pot limit. And then on August 15th, we had a meeting of our Crab Advisory Board to develop the actual proposed rules that we'll be reviewing with you here shortly. We filed those proposed rule changes in a CR 102, which you should all have a copy of in front of you. We then had a crab industry and stakeholder workshop on September 30th to walk them through each of those rule changes, what the intent and purpose rationale was behind those, and to solicit public comment. That proposed rule then published in the state register. We mailed it to all license holders with the letter that you have in your packet. And we also noted there are additional public comment opportunities.
All right. So I'm going to walk you through the rule changes that we're proposing here. This first change is to require only the amount of line necessary. So our coastal crab fishermen have been engaged in the Washington Whale Entanglement Working Group since the fall of 2017 to discuss this issue and how they want to see changes made and reduce encounters with whales. So through this group, they developed a best practices guidelines for the coastal crab fishery. This proposal would implement a key best practice guideline into regulation by requiring only the amount of line necessary to compensate for tides, currents, and weather. The way we've crafted this rule is important. It recognizes something that Michelle touched on in the beginning, and that's the unique nature of the crab fishery off Washington coast. Extreme fishing conditions when this fishery occurs, including strong tides and currents and seasonal variability. So specifying the exact amount of line in this rule would be challenging, if not dangerous. This next proposed rule, the intent here is to reduce the risk of whales becoming entangled in commercial crab gear simply by reducing the number of lines in the water during the time period when humpback whales are more abundant off the Washington coast. This rule would be coupled with a new buoy tag requirement that, as Michelle also mentioned, is how we ensure compliance with our pot limit. And then I just want to mention that we hope that with the summer buoy tag in the future, we can also allow what we have currently is a lost and abandoned pot removal program that we've had in place for many years. It's a successful program. With the summer buoy tag, we could potentially down the road start that gear recovery sooner. So this would just distinguish these summer fishing pots from pots that maybe have lost during the winter season. The next rule change, this is regarding replacement tags. Basically, through the pot limit program, fishermen are allowed to get a certain amount of replacement tags each year so they can keep fishing their 500 or 300 pot limits. This change would just streamline the replacement tag program to align it with the new summer buoy tag requirement. Otherwise, they would overlap to some degree. So currently, replacement tags will still be available March through April, but then no replacement tags will be offered after May 1, as those fishermen will be getting their new summer tag. This next rule change is to require line marking specific to Washington. This proposed change would require crabbers to mark their lines so that it can be identified as Washington coastal crab gear. And that goes back to the slide that Michelle mentioned earlier, where NOAA whale entanglement responders show that approximately half of confirmed entanglements cannot be attributed to a specific fishery. It makes it difficult to assess whether regulatory changes are effective, identify additional tools that might reduce the risk of entanglements, and monitor compliance. We're coordinating this effort with the states of Oregon and California just to ensure that as we go forward, it's unique to Washington. This will help not just WDFW, but also NOAA assess the effectiveness of our management tools. By far, this proposed change has had the most discussion within our crab advisory board and our industry meetings. So what we've tried to do through the proposed language is just be somewhat broad to let our crab fleet, to provide them the flexibility to implement this change in a way that works for their fishing operations. So what were the requirement as written is that the line would be marked with red in at least two places, at the top near the buoy and at the bottom near the pot. And we haven't gone into any detail about whether that marking would be paint or tape or twine, recognizing that we can refine this management tool as we learn more, as we hear more from our crab industry about what is a better plan for them. This rule, as written, just gets it out the door and gets something in place for this current season. Currently, as as the rule changes in front of you, it would be implemented upon the effective date of the rule and in effect year-round. Through our discussions with our advisory board and our industry members, we are recommending that this include an effective date of May 1 for the final rule and to require it year-round thereafter. So the May 1 would align it with that buoy tag requirement. It's also a time of transition in our coastal Dungeness crab fishery where there's a smaller amount of participants. A lot of folks will go off to participate in other fisheries in Alaska or salmon or albacore tuna. And so this change would delay that implementation until May 2020.
Sure, thanks. I just wanted to add a little bit to the rationale for this proposal. As Heather mentioned, there's roughly about half of the entanglements that are confirmed that cannot be attributed to a specific fishery or to a specific state. And that is because almost always you don't get to see the actual pot itself. So you'll see line that is wrapped around the whale, but half the time you can see the buoy or a buoy tag, but it's going to be done in the context of either an overflight or a boat that's a considerable distance away and trying to decipher through photographs what the buoy brand is or the buoy tag that's specific to a state or fishery. But half the time, the buoy is gone or missing. It could have been removed by the whale. It could have been, could be submerged. Oftentimes, the line is in the whale's baleen, or it could have been clipped off by a ship or some other means. So what the line marking does is it provides in this case, if we have some section of line that is visible, again, either through from the air or from an adjacent boat or something where we can actually see the rope that is wrapped around the whale, this gives us a better chance if there's a unique line color for Washington that they will, NOAA responders will at least be able to attribute it to a specific state or fishery by that individual state color.
Very close to my question right there, because I wondered about the buoys. But you mentioned line color, so and you said you're coordinating with other states, so I wondered about, you know, one state has to use green line, one state has to use yellow line, and one state can use white line and not have the markings. I imagine you're still having those kind of discussions. But my first question was, if the buoy's there, why does there need to be any marking at all? And you explain that.
Yes, thank you. Do you want to?
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. We do, our Washington crab fishery has, through our regulations, has required specific color marking of each crab fisherman's buoys. So we've had that in place for many, many years. We have a registry of the buoy colors associated with each license. And they also have a unique buoy brand. So each license has a buoy brand. Those buoys have a buoy brand and a buoy color. Just to say, these are some rules that the other states are just now considering but have been in place for a long time for the Washington crab fishery.
If I may also add to that, too, In terms of regulations on fisheries in general, the coastal crab fishery is not what I would consider to be heavily regulated or complicated in their regulations. However, in comparing across the three states, by far, Washington has implemented regulations the most stringent to limit the effort in the fishery to have individual markings of the buoys and the pots in the fishery to implement not only limited entry licenses, but pot limits as well. That is not necessarily consistent across all three states. even though there has been a lot of questions and comments relative to the line marking, through our industry workshops, by far the consistent desire that we've heard from all of the participants is to have a Washington-specific permit. They do not want to have a permit that includes states of Oregon or California or other fisheries. The phrase we use really often is joined at the hip. They would rather be individually responsible for their actions and not have the actions of other fisheries outside of their control affect their ability to continue fishing. NIMS has made it really clear that in order to have individual state permit issues, they need to be able to differentiate the gear from the different states. And that is where the line marking comes in. So if Washington wants to have our own permit, we need to have regulations such that the NOAA whale responders can differentiate that gear and attribute it appropriately to Washington.
Commissioner, I understand that. I guess my question is if Washington has a separate program from Oregon, from California, you're still being managed to the combined Washington, Oregon, California number. And if you mentioned 1.67, so if Washington has a separate program, but California, for instance, has entanglement and there's a determination that there's a problem, then it seems like it wouldn't matter what Washington had or what Oregon had, they would be affected by the calculations or the lumping that NOAA has, or the way they do the calculations. Is that correct? I mean, I guess I understand the concept of being separate and being able to manage it, but I think there's a risk regardless.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Anderson. There is a risk regardless, and this goes back to trying to reconcile the limit established in the MMPA versus the negligible impact description in the ESA. And it also ties into the composition of the whale populations off of each state. Washington is the only state of the three to have that Hawaiian population off our state. So Oregon's, the humpback whales that are off of Oregon and California are only of those populations that are listed under the ESA. So in terms of being held accountable to a total number, in that respect, Washington does fare better than the other two states because we have almost half of the humpback whales that occur off our state being the delisted population.
I'm sure the commercial fleet has figured this out already or well, but the one slide about have the line only as long as it needs to be, what formula do you use for that? I mean, if the fisher's going to lay his gear out in 150 feet of water, how much line do you let him have? I mean, how does it work? And what if he's got a bunch of pots on the boat that have different line lengths for fishing on different depths and different? Somebody's going to have to help me with that one.
And if I could attach on to that, because I was going to ask the question later, what's the response of enforcement to this? Because they're always concerned about vagueness. At least we hear that. So have they been involved in this discussion?
Thank you, Chair Carpenter and Commissioner Thorburn. I'll try to address that. And we talked about this really as a potential educational tool. So clearly it's going to be different. The amount of line you need is going to be different depending on the time of year, how strong the current is running, how deep you're fishing your gear. We really want that to be up to the fishermen. And there will be an element of self-reporting, of enforcement, you know, having the opportunity to see a bunch of line floating at the surface and educate that. that fisherman on what they do. And there was a strong interest by our folks that worked on this well and working group, understanding the challenges with enforcing this rule, but bringing their best practices into regulation and showing their commitment to managing this problem. So recognizing there are potential enforcement issues. Okay, so proposed rule number 5, this is just removing reference to ring nets as commercial gear. Right now, it's something of a housekeeping change. Our pot limit is specific to crab pots, and if we don't make this change, there's a potential someone could add on ring nets and increase their gear pile from 500 to 300. I don't know that anybody would do that on the coast, but so this is basically a housekeeping rule change.
So just to go over what our proposed next steps are relative to whale entanglement outreach and the proposed rule package you have in front of you. On November 6th, we have another crab industry and stakeholder workshop scheduled. We have also for that workshop lined up individuals to come and speak and provide presentations. We have our coordinator lead for the incidental take permit process from NIMS Protected Resources Division that will attend that meeting. We also have invited John Kalambakides, who is the head of Cascadia Research and the lead for calculating the amounts and the composition of the humpback whales off of the West Coast, and Doug Sandilands, who is the trained NOAA responder and lead for the response group, will also be providing a presentation. We'll also have a public hearing at that workshop where we will review these rule changes and take public comment on those rules. And then we will bring these back to the commission at your January meeting for you to consider them for adoption. Continuing on in 2020, we plan to have stakeholder workshops to promote education and discuss potential actions to avoid and reduce whale entanglements. We also plan to solicit feedback from our industry members on these proposed new regulatory changes. As Heather mentioned, in particular, the line marking, which is intentionally vague, we want to hear what works best for them. Is it spray paint? Is it weaving a red line through their broader rope? Is it, do we have the right amount of area to be covered? Do we have it placed in the right place? Those types of things. So if we need to change our regulations, we can be responsive to those comments. We will also be pursuing our incidental take permit and completing the application and that conservation plan that I mentioned. We have a target submission date of December 2020 to complete and submit that. May have also have heard as part of the agency request legislation and budget package that the agency has requested $290,000 for the biennium starting in fiscal year 21. That will allow us to hire a permanent biologist to help us complete the incidental take permit application, accompanying NEPA documents and analysis, as well as monitor our compliance with that incidental take permit application. And then it also includes about $50,000 of that would allow us to continue stakeholder outreach and education workshops on this issue. So with that, we'd be happy to take additional questions.
Commissioner McKaysey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On proposed rule number 2, reduce the pot limit. has there been an economic impact analysis of this? Would there be expected to be a reduction in the crab take from this? And so do you have one of those done already? Have you looked at that? Are you going to? And by the time we get to a final decision, would we have that?
Yes, thank you. So we did take a look at whether the proposed rule changes would result in a more than minor cost estimate to comply with. We did not find that the proposed rule changes you have in front of you, including the pot reduction as well as the requirement for the summer buoy tags, would exceed that more than minor threshold. Specific to the pot limit reduction, as we mentioned, we do see a natural transition in the crab fishery that occurs about the 1st of May. We have quite a few of our crab fishers that will go to participate in fisheries off of Alaska or other West Coast fishing opportunities that are available here. We also did implement the pot reduction this year, beginning July 1. Did not see any reduction in landings as a result of that reduced pot limit.
Okay. Ladies, well done, as always. We do have three folks for open public comment, so don't go far. We may need you. Okay, the three folks, I'd like to have you all come up at the same time, if you'd be kind enough. Dale Beasley. Sophia, is it Dessler?
Wrestler,
I'm sorry. And Larry Thievick. And I didn't get that right either, I'm sure. Close enough?
Yeah.
You've been here before, I expect. You know you have 3 minutes, and we'll see if there's any questions at the end. Mr. Beasley.
For the record, my name is Dale Beasley. I'm president of the Columbia River Crab Fishermen's Association and the Coalition of Coastal Fisheries. I'm a fourth-generation fisherman. I fished for 45 years, and I'm currently retired. First time I went fishing was 1958. 60 years, I've witnessed a lot of change in the fisheries, and it's not all been for the better. This is one of those that doesn't go for the better. I had some prepared comments here today, but after listening, I think I'm going to tell you what actions we are going to take. Number one, we support the majority of the regulation changes, and I want to put it on the record that these are not for conservation purposes, and they are not for meeting our tribal obligations. These are to prevent a lawsuit by the Center of Biological Diversity against our department, and we don't wish them to have to go through that. You've seen some pretty small numbers here that we've entangled in our fishery. And I've sent you three written notices here. And I would like to especially point out the letter from Senator Magnuson in 1974. We were worried about the whales back then. Our fishing fleet has done more for whales than anybody in the world. When this was established with the FCMA, there was a reason that these whales were considered back in 1974, 2 years before the Magnuson-Stevenson Act, and that was to get their numbers back up. And we've done too good a job to getting them back up, and now they're starting to interfere with our other fisheries and causing us some trouble. We don't know where this is going to lead in the fishery. We could end up with one or two takes that we don't even know what we're taking. These things are lumped up, you know, with the three individual whale groups. The Hawaiian ones are definitely not on an ESA list. I think we should be questioning the Mexican ones if there's enough for them to even be on a threatened endangered list. And in 10 days, I'm going to be making a trip to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to be talking to congressional staff to look at the MMPA and the ESA to give our fishing fleets some relief from having to shut down over a couple of whales that the reason we're having a problem with them today is because we did such a good job of recovering them. And so I have a couple of comments about the recent rule regulations. We believe the 12-inch line marking is enough. It just gets more complicated, especially if you start using twine every time you tuck in a rope. For instance, it puts a weak spot in a rope, chance to break, lose that gear. It's getting too expensive to lose. Also, the time of implementation of that should be at the start of the season. 2020 and the 2021 season, not in the middle of the season. It's just problematic for the fleet that's left fishing to comply with that completely, and it'll be an enforcement nightmare if the guys can't get it done, and it's just really impractical.
Dale, can you wrap it up a little bit? We're over 3 minutes, so we got a ways to go yet. Please.
Sure, I can do that if you'll promise to read the stuff I sent you.
That's a fact. Are you done?
Can I have one more comment?
8 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. If we work on getting other alternative fisheries in better shape for our crabbers, we can remove lines without impacting the current economics of our fisheries. All our things are tied together, and the current situation we're in now has led to a number of fatalities in our Washington and Oregon fisheries. We have the highest fatality rate of any occupation in the nation as a result of some of our prior things, like trying to comply with our tribal situation where we've lost 50% of crabs on 70% of our coast. So the thing is, we want to keep our fishermen healthy, you know, and I don't think we're impacting the whale populations that are growing at 6 to 8% a year.
Thank you for your comments. Sophia?
Sure. Hi again, Chair Carpenter and Commissioners. Thanks again for the time you're taking to do all of this and to listen to our comments. Again, I'm Sophia Ressler here on behalf of the Center for Biological Diversity. We are here to, first of all, thank the department for the work that they've already done on this issue. We think that it's a really pressing matter for endangered whales. We're very happy to see that the department has come up with a timeline to apply for an incidental take permit under the Endangered Species Act, and we urge the department to stick to this timeline. Washington's coast is vitally important to both humpbacks and southern resident killer whales, and while Washington's fisheries have not entangled any orcas yet, California's fisheries have, as recently as October 2019. We certainly can't afford to entangle any southern resident killer whales, so I think that that's another component that we should be thinking about in all of this. We would urge the department to consider something not in the rules during the further stakeholder conversations in 2020, and that would be to require the fisheries to start testing and using ropeless gear as soon as possible, which would allow us to have viable whale populations and a successful fishing industry. And I just want to end with the fact that the Endangered Species Act works. It is an incredibly successful piece of legislation. Whales are good for our oceans. They're good for humans. They are nutrient pumps. They sequester carbon. And they also support a growing whale watching industry. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not familiar with ropeless crab gear. Could you explain that?
I would have to put you in touch with I've actually haven't been the person that's the lead on this. I'm just happened to be our person in Washington, so I'm here on behalf of some of our other ocean team members just giving testimony, but I'd be happy to get you in touch with our team in California to talk more about that with you.
One second. Michelle or Heather, do either one of you know? Could you tell us about this?
I'll give it a shot. It's okay. It's a relatively new gear, and it's being tested a lot relative to the right whale issue on the East Coast. One of our WDFW staff just went to a gear testing workshop in California. It's very new. It's somewhat expensive as far as I know, but basically what it does, you put a pot in the water and it has no rope to the surface. When your vessel approaches the pot, you know by GPS where you are and you press a button and the buoy comes up and then you retrieve your gear. As far as I know, it needs a little bit of work.
Yeah, it sounds like Thank you very much.
And just to reiterate, my request was just to start those discussions and start considering, you know, new technology like that in these issues.
Thank you. I know we got to stay out of here. Oh, excuse me, Commissioner Anderson.
Just a quick question. You moved to Southern Resident Killer Whale Protections, and I'm curious as to what, in addition to is already being proposed, that you're suggesting might be to reduce potential impact to southern resident killer whales.
I mean, I think that what I was saying was, you know, thank you for the rules that are already being proposed. The no line fishing gear is another potential discussion to be had, and just thinking about you know, new and innovative solutions that we might be using in order to avoid not only humpback entanglement but also entanglement of the southern residents.
Okay. Larry?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, director. My name is Larry Thievick. I'm the president of the Washington Dungeness Crab Fishermen's Association. The Dungeness crab fishery is the most valuable single-species fishery on the West Coast. Preserving access to our crab resource is synonymous with preserving the economic viability of our coastal fishing communities. Fishers and managers have met in good faith and proposed actions that we all hope will mitigate and minimize humpback entanglements while the incidental take permit process runs its course. While any entanglement is bad for both fishers and whales, it is expected that an ITP will allow a take greater than zero once granted. Documented incidence of humpback entanglements with Washington coastal crab gear is relatively low. Over the last 20 seasons, there have been 9 known humpback entanglements with Washington coastal crab gear, which represents less than 10% of the total coastwide crab gear entanglements during that same period. It is important to note, as was mentioned by Michelle, that around 50% of the humpback whales that visit the Washington coast are non-listed whales. So when an entanglement does occur in the Washington coastal fishery, it is as likely to be a non-listed Hawaiian humpback as it is to be a listed humpback. It is also encouraging that despite increasing entanglements, humpback populations are growing at an estimated rate of 5-7% annually. The rule changes for your consideration will significantly alter the crab fishery during periods of the season when potential interaction with humpbacks are most likely to occur. Where the Crab Association departs from the rule package is the implementation timeline for line marking and the length of the required mark. I request that the implementation for the line marking requirement within the rule package be delayed until the opening of the 2021 crab season. If the commission adopts the rule requiring line marking, your intent to make a good faith change is clear and it is codified. It makes more sense, is less confusing and problematic, and will likely have more compliance when implementation coincides with the opening of the season. Implementing this rule in the middle of the upcoming season will not have any impact on whether any whales will be entangled or not entangled. It will, however, be a tool to help with the attribution of the entanglement in the future. A delayed implementation will allow the fleet time to research which line marking options are most effective, whether it be the use of paint, tape, tags, twine, or line. We need data on the options related to durability, visibility, potential additional entanglement risk, the workload, which I've calculated to be about 100 hours, and costs. I also request that the length of the mark revert to the 12 inches as had been discussed during most of the state and industry meetings. And I will be submitting written comment to help clarify my rule change requests. And since the timer hasn't gone off yet, unless I didn't hear it, I did want to say that relative to the ropeless gear, there's been no viable ropeless gear option that's been developed to this date. That doesn't mean technology can't come up with something down the road, but to think that there's an option available now is just not true. And thank you for your time.
Commercial fisheries and other places for Dungeness crab. I know that they put a metal tag that's good for, I don't know, 36, 48 hours. The buoy's down at the pot at the bottom. And at some point in time, depending on how long it takes to corrode, the pot pops up. Has there been any work done or consideration of that?
Well, as Sophia said, I mean, the discussion should be had.
I think so. Yeah.
Now, the viability of that option for the unique characteristics of the Washington coastal crab fishery, where we have extreme weather events and we have really strong currents and we have a lot of gear in almost the same place, the idea of having gear on the bottom with nothing showing at the top, when you're a fisher trying to come along and figure out where somebody else is, you may end up actually exacerbating entanglements before things are done by having gear down at the bottom tangled with other gear. So I'm not saying we shouldn't have the discussion. What I'm trying to say is there just truly is not at this time any technology that would provide for ropeless gear that would work off of the Washington coast.
Okay, Commissioner Baker?
Well, my question was a variant of that exact question. I assume that you guys have been working with the department and probably other fisheries around the world to figure out a good way to mark line so that it can be observed from a distance and we can figure out what state it is. It really is like spray painting a foot on a 150-foot line. Is that the best we can do, or are there other ways that we aren't considering that if a line is wrapped around a whale, we could identify which state it comes from?
Well, I'd like to think that what we are doing now is a step in the right direction, and that we could have an evolutionary process to try to come up with something that might be closer to satisfying what you're talking about. But right now, even having, you know, the limited marking that we're talking about now, it may not suit for a flyover. But if indeed there's an entanglement and there's whale disentanglers that have a chance to get to that whale, or unfortunately if the whale were to come up on the beach, it might be more likely that we could identify the source of that entanglement and the fishing activity that caused it, even with the marks that we're talking about. And part of the problem is, you know, we are trying to come up with some solutions now to help demonstrate that we truly are taking this seriously, we're kind of in a dilemma. I mean, on the one hand, we've been trying to do what we can do to help mitigate and minimize whale entanglements. On the other hand, we have this threat of a lawsuit potentially for activities that we do now that maybe 5 years from now would actually not be illegal. So we're trying to demonstrate that good faith without really having the adequate time to get to an answer that you're asking. So I would like to think, and especially if we wait until the 2021, maybe we would have a chance then during the summer to experiment with some of the tag marks, still knowing that at 2021, the beginning of the season, we'd have to comply with the red line mark of, I hope, 12 inches, not 18. But I would like to think that as we go forward, we would come up with something that might get us to a better answer even than that. We're trying to have a partial answer now because it's an immediate problem.
Well, I think this has been very enlightening. The three of you making public comment is very appreciated. And Heather and Michelle, thank you. I think to be continued.